This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. With the Oscars coming up next weekend, we're digging into how movie stars create their art. And to get there, we turn to the Cahiers du Cinéma, which at one time was the journal, not only for film criticism, but for inciting a wholesale reevaluation of how films got made. Founded in Paris in 1951, the Notebooks of Film, as translated into English, championed the French New Wave and poo-pooed the American Technicolor movies of the era, along with film noir and anything by Hitchcock. The international arts publishing house Fiden purchased the Cahiers du Cinéma a few years ago and has released a series on the craft called Anatomy of an Actor. Four of these coffee table-sized volumes have come out so far, focusing on what made the performances of Jack Nicholson, Meryl Streep, Al Pacino, and Marlon Brando so memorable. Philip Masiak is assistant professor of film studies at Louisiana State University. He writes the Dear Television column at the Los Angeles Review of Books, and he wrote about the Nicholson and Streep volumes of the Anatomy of an Actor series for Slate. Philip Masiak, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first, a little background on the series and the Cahiers du Cinéma. Fiden purchased Cahiers in 2009, already produced a series on great directors. What do you think they were aiming for with the focus on actors?
Well, I think that the director's art has been, over the past decades, an art that has been really thoroughly examined empirically. I think we know how directors create shots. We know a great deal because of periodicals like the Cahiers du Cinéma and interviews with directors. We know a great deal about how directors approach their craft, and we see them to some extent as craftsmen. We see them as people who are measuring things, lighting things, and sort of using the tools at their disposal to create a work of art. And I think that acting, to some extent, has not received as extended a treatment in that regard as directing has. You know, we talk about method acting as the sort of most famous way that we can think about actors, but even that process, which is a process, is shrouded in a kind of illusion. They replayed a great Philip Seymour Hoffman interview with Terry Gross last week, and he called it acting mumbo jumbo. And I think that that's really right about the way that the public perceives the actor's craft, that it is a kind of magical thing, right? You close your eyes, you put your hand over your face, and all of a sudden you create a part. Whereas I think there's a great deal more labor and intellect that goes into it that we don't explore quite so much.
Film acting is the last great mystery of the contemporary cinema, is how you put it in your article. But can this mystery be so easily described or even understood?
I mean, I think that's the great question, and that's one of the reasons why I think that aspect gets a little bit of a short shrift. It isn't as technical as the director's work, and so it's often more difficult, I think, for actors to describe what precisely they're doing. The book that I focus on primarily in the article, this about Meryl Streep by the wonderful critic Carina Longworth, that's one of the reasons this book succeeds, is because Meryl Streep is so sort of phenomenally articulate about all of the thought that she puts into the roles that she creates, both at the level of, you know, scene work. So, you know, what am I thinking about when I'm doing the scene? How am I creating this accent? But also at the level of where the role fits into a larger cultural narrative. Mm-hmm. Meryl Streep is extraordinarily articulate and extraordinarily smart about the way that she approaches her roles as sort of political acts.
Well, let's dig into this then. The series,
sure.
Anatomy of an Actor, it's contemporary critics concentrating on 10 performances each. We mentioned Jack Nicholson, Al Pacino, Marlon Brando, and Meryl Streep. So let's look at Meryl Streep. Big breakthrough role as Linda in Michael Cimino's 1978 film, The Deer Hunter, followed shortly by Oscars for Kramer versus Kramer, and shortly after that, Sophie's Choice. Now, here is a scene that you write about, the courtroom scene from Kramer versus Kramer. Let's roll this. This is Meryl Streep as Joanna Kramer. She's on the stand making the case why she should have custody of her son.
I'm not saying he doesn't need his father, but I really believe he needs me more. I was his mommy for 5.5 years, and Ted took over that role for 18 months. I don't know how anybody can possibly believe that I have less of a stake in mothering that little boy than Mr. Kramer does.
Meryl Streep, their eyes convincingly welling up with tears. Walk us through that clip in the larger courtroom scene. What is Streep drawing on there?
Well, I think that one of the narratives that's most compelling that Longworth draws in her book about this and in her close attention to the scene is that Meryl Streep, in her early career, as many many actresses were during this period, faced with a lot of roles that were underwritten. And one of the things that Meryl Streep really appeared to put a lot of energy into doing was exercising the sort of small amount of power that her talent had given her to try to shape these roles into more well-rounded roles, to roles that spoke more of women's experiences. And this scene in particular is a really great example of that, because she entered into this film, Kramer versus Kramer, which as a popular novel beforehand had a kind of reputation as a novel about sort of female villainy to some extent, about how this woman could leave her family. And she felt very, very committed to the idea that this was a character whose choices were understandable, whose choices were worth thinking about. And she was actually given in this scene the opportunity to write her own dialogue. And I think that's why it makes a particularly good example of what Meryl Streep has been so good at, is simply making roles her own, in this case, literally.
Philip, her quick rise to fame has sparked a couple of backlashes through the years. There was a time when she was accused of getting paid too much. You know, it said she couldn't open a film. She was too serious. And then when she made a comedy, she was not a comedian. But reading the comments of your review, the biggest issue people seem to have with Meryl Streep is her accents. What's going on here?
I feel like this is to some extent the side problem that results from us not really talking that much about acting craft. The one thing that anybody can zero into when talking about how an actor produces a work is whether or not they're doing an accent. And I think for Meryl Streep especially, because she's done such a wide array of different types of accents and become sort of famous for it, that becomes very easily a thing that people who either are objecting to the work that she does or don't particularly care for her as an actress, to zero in on that particular element of any performance and say, oh, she's just doing that accent again. It's as you said, difficult to describe why a particular performance is great, but there are a lot of resources at hand for people in comment sections to talk about why a performance is bad.
Philip Masyak is with us. He teaches film studies at LSU, and he also wrote a review about Fiden's Anatomy of an Actor series. He wrote about it for Slate. We're kind of looking at that performance with the Academy Awards just coming up. Let's talk about the man that Streep is rumored to have had an affair with during their filming of Ironweed, Jack Nicholson. This book by Beverly Walker. What makes Jack Nicholson worth studying? He doesn't seem to have had the same sort of academic approach to acting as Meryl Streep did, certainly.
There was a particular comment in the comment section that I thought was a particularly interesting way of thinking about the difference between the two characters. Somebody said the difference between Meryl Streep and Jack Nicholson is that Meryl Streep is an actor and Jack Nicholson is a movie star. And I think that one of the things that becomes interesting about Jack Nicholson is that after a certain point, his phenomenal run of great roles in the 70s, the reputation he had for those roles began to be matched by his public persona. And I think it produces both something interesting and also a challenge in writing about actors who are also extraordinary celebrities, because it bifurcates the subject. You have two things that you can write about.
He's one of that small club of actors who has won 3 Oscars, one in the 70s, one in the 80s, and one in the 90s, interestingly enough. Here he is in one of the strongest performances, to my mind, that great run in the 70s with the Chinatown, you know, 5 Easy Pieces, The Last Detail, and this one. He is playing Randall McMurphy in the film adaptation of Ken Kesey's novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest from 1975.
Do you think it might be possible to turn that music down so maybe a couple of the boys could talk?
That music is for everyone, Mr. McMurphy.
Yeah, I know, but you think we might ease it down a little bit so maybe the boys didn't have to shout? Huh?
What you probably don't realize is that we have a lot of old men on this ward who couldn't hear the music if we turned it lower. That music is all they have. Your hand is staining my window.
Sorry, ma'am.
All right.
Sorry.
Mr. McMurphy.
Huh?
Your medication.
Oh, the withering Nurse Ratched, played by Louise Fletcher there at the end. But this is the thing that people say, that Jack Nicholson doesn't act anymore. He's just Jack Nicholson playing Jack Nicholson. So is this it, Philip? Is the true test of an actor forgetting who they are in a role?
I'm not sure if that's the true test, but it's certainly something that, plays into it. And I think it's one of the things that people, I mean, as much as I say in the article that we need to move away from the model of thinking about acting as magic, and thinking about it instead as work or as a craft or as something with a distinct process. I mean, I think that's not to deny the fact that there is something sort of magical about acting, and part of that is the idea of forgetting that that someone is playing a particular role. And I think Jack Nicholson has certainly played a fair number of roles that could easily have been characters based on Jack Nicholson. You see something even later in life in a film like Something's Gotta Give with this sort of aging Lothario. But then you look at something like About Schmidt, where he plays in Alexander Payne's great film, he plays a sort of, you know, diminished version of himself. And in that film, I find it pretty easy to forget that that's Jack Nicholson.
Well, Philip, you did not review the books on the other two great actors in this series, Al Pacino and Marlon Brando. But I am curious to know about the field of actors that is out there now. Where are they picking up from the greats, and where are they departing?
Well, I think that one of the things that you see, you know, we don't talk about Christian Bale necessarily as a method actor, but we certainly see the kind of
extreme weight loss and gain.
the extreme weight loss and gain, the hair pieces, his American accent, which sounds suspiciously like Robert De Niro's American accent, really sort of put him, I think, almost self-consciously in the lineage of those sort of actors of the new Hollywood. I think it's really interesting to see someone like Matthew McConaughey, especially thinking, as we just were, about the career of Jack Nicholson. One of the really interesting things that that Walker really draws out in her book is about how formative Nicholson's early years in the Roger Corman company were. He was acting in these sort of pulpy movies and in many cases writing them, and really sort of working on his craft in movies that were not great movies. And Bruce Dern, the same thing is true of Bruce Dern. And I think that Matthew McConaughey was not certainly in sort of pulpy films, but he did this long stretch in the popular romantic comedy where, you know, he was, I think, often accused of, you know, just showing up for a paycheck and not really being that interested. And one of the narratives that's emerged over the past couple of years during what various critics have called the McConaissance is the idea that he's beginning to be interested in his work again. And he said things to that effect in interviews as well. And I think that what's really fascinating to watch here is an actor who had essentially been acting on autopilot for a little while. And we're seeing what he's capable of doing when he really locks in, when he really starts thinking about roles and the kind of diversity of roles that he's been able to play on, certainly in Dallas Buyers Club, but also in True Detective, which I would suggest is one of the best performances that he's done, to really, again, show this kind of control and show the choices that he's making as an actor.
And you would know, you're right down there in Southeast Louisiana, Southwest
Louisiana.
Where all
television programs are set.
Philip Maciak, he's assistant professor of film studies at LSU. He's also author of the Dear Television column at the Los Angeles Review of Books. He also reviewed the Anatomy of an Actor series for Slate magazine. You can find a link to more at wordofmouthradio.org.
From the dusty mesa, a looming shadow.
There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You know that feeling when you and a friend are in conversation over text? You've just composed and then sent a brilliant little message, and this little bubble with the blinking dots shows up on your phone, indicating that your friend is typing. So you wait in anticipation, maybe only to receive a two-word response, ha-ha, or worse, No response at all. If that drives you crazy, David Auerbach may be to blame. He's a software engineer and critic, and he writes the weekly Bitwise column for Slate. He helped design the typing indicator, now used on everything from GChat to the iPhone. And he is not apologizing, as his recent column for Slate says, brazenly enough. I built that so-and-so is typing feature in chat, and I'm not sorry. David Auerbach, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the so-and-so typing feature is just one of those things that seems to have been around forever. When did you develop it?
Well, it was me and a couple other people on the MSN Messenger team at Microsoft back in 1998 and 1999. It eventually shipped in 1999.
Wow, so in early 1999, early 2000s, that was when people weren't texting. We were using dial-up for the most part. So give us a snapshot of what instant messaging was like back in those dark ages.
There were a couple apps around then. There's AOL's. There was a program called ICQ, which the old timers might remember. But, you know, broadband was not particularly widespread at the time. And so people were not always logged on. And worse, dial-up had a habit of cutting out. Sometimes call waiting would be enough to kick you offline.
Right.
And so for a lot of reasons, you would get into situations where you would be chatting with a friend over instant message, and there'd be a pause in between messages. Either you wouldn't be sure who it was who was supposed to be responding, whether you know the other person was going to say something more or whether it was your turn. Or even worse, you could see that they were online when they'd actually been cut off. So the thinking was to have a little message that said whether or not the person on the other end was currently just typing text, whether or not they'd sent it to you yet. In its initial form, it would be a message that said, you know, X is typing a message. The little icon and flashing dot, dot, dots came later. That was how it was initially envisioned, and it turned out to be quite a hit and was copied, I think, by pretty much all the competitors pretty quickly.
Well, our technology has leapfrogged forward since that. How about this interpretation of the typing indicator? Do people still see it in the same way?
Some people seem annoyed by it. I think etiquette on instant messaging has developed to the point where I think people have a lot better sense of the back and forth. But depending on who you talk to, some people seem to say, oh, I love it. It gives me more feedback on what I'm doing. Other people say, oh God, it's horrific. I wish it was not there. It makes me feel like I'm not typing fast enough, or it makes me feel like the other person knows that I might be typing too much. So if I then erase it all, they then knew that I was typing a lot. And I would say that in our defense, we allowed you to turn off the feature. And I don't think most programs these days give you much of a choice.
So as a developer, it was certainly successful. And as we said in the title of your article, you're not apologizing for helping to develop the so-and-so is a typing feature in chat. How about you personally, as a user? How do you feel about your own invention?
Well, I do want to give credit to the handful of people. It was a couple people on the team, so it was not just me. So a shout out to some people who might want to remain nameless, but I remember you, and it was good times back then. I like it. I like having lots of feedback. I type very fast, so if anything, I wish there was more feedback. There used to be a program called Talk. And in that, you would see what the other person was typing character by character. It wouldn't be message by message. And so you could sort of guess what the other person was saying before they even finished typing it.
What I find so interesting is that kind of cross-typing phenomenon. You know, like you'll be having a conversation with somebody and they'll start typing something. You'll start answering the old thing, see that they're typing and think they've moved on to another thing. And you don't know where we are in the conversation. What can we do about that?
Oh, well, it's just like what we're doing right here, right now.
That's such a strange phenomenon, David, talking to each other.
I know. Well, if we could talk at the same time, you know, that would be even faster. But but I suppose talking is good in its old-fashioned way.
Dot, dot, dot. I'm thinking of a response. It also sort of glosses over the
nuances of a real conversation, obviously, when you're texting each other. Do you think you somebody or you might be a part of a team that develops a sarcasm font?
Well, okay, here's something that wasn't in the article I'll tell you, which is that I was also the person who did the thing that turns text smileys into graphical smileys.
David Auerbach, you're the winner of the internet.
Well, it is possible someone in South Korea came up with that before I did it, but I'm pretty sure I was the first in this country in the Western world to do it.
David Auerbach, I want to thank you for illuminating that for us today. Appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you.
David Auerbach is software engineer and critic. He writes the weekly Bitwise column for Slate on technology, and he was part of a team, let it be noted, that helped develop the so-and-so is typing feature in chat. He says he's not sorry, and you can read his article about that at slate.com. Stay with us for more Word of Mouth right after the break here on NHPR.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Love is in the air on Word of Mouth today, and that's the whole spectrum of love, not just for humans. Master dog trainer David Latimer once said, "Animals other than humans love unconditionally. Put your spouse and your dog in the trunk of your car for 3 hours and see which one is happy to see you when you let them out." It's with that quote that our guest Jennifer Holland begins her new book, Unlikely Loves. It's a collection of exceptionally cute photos and stories of friendships between two different species of animals. Jennifer Holland, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me back.
Now, your first book, Unlikely Friendship, spent about 44 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. First, did you expect such a reaction? And secondly, why do you think people responded so strongly to the book?
You know, I really had no idea. I knew it was the kind of subject that people like. You know, everyone's always sending around those kinds of pictures on the internet. But I really had no idea it was going to hit such a nerve with people. But I think the timing is very good for positive stories, for good news. You know, we're all kind of struggling with the way of the world. And I think, you know, to read about something that's positive and happy that gives us kind of a good impression is a really necessary thing right now. So I think that's one reason that people gravitate toward these types of stories right now.
Well, people are more demanding than dogs, and they wanted more. So here we are in the introduction of your new book, Unlikely Loves. You first say that animal behavioralists might bristle at the word love in the title because it's a human emotion that we project onto animals. What are your thoughts on the affection that animals show to humans and to each other?
It is a tricky thing. I'm trained as a science writer, and so I'm always a little bit wary about some of the terminology. But I think that, you know, we're learning more and more about how animals think and how animals feel, at least to the degree that we can possibly do so. And I think there is a lot more overlap than people ever believed before. And so to use a word like love, it may not be exactly the same experience for an animal as it is for us, but I think it's not really that far off. I think there's a lot of overlap between how we feel and how they feel.
Well, it certainly looks so in the pictures. And let's jump into this book. And I should mention that there are more than 40 stories, each with big, generally very adorable photographs. We won't be able to get to them all here, but listeners can go to wordofmouthradio.org to see some of these really cute photographs. The book is divided into three sections. The first is called Who Loves Your Baby? About one animal parenting, I guess, another of a different species. Tell us a little bit about one of them. We've got Great Dane and the fawn. I always think Great Danes have a reputation for being aggressive. It doesn't look like it in this case.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story, in particular because the fawn is blind. And this is one of those cases in which a dog, it typically is a dog that you hear about with these kinds of stories, but takes over and sort of becomes the seeing eye animal for another species, and in this case, a vet brought home this deer to take care of it. It was injured and it was blind. And her dog immediately took to it, and they became very, very close friends. There's no other way to describe it, really. And also the dog really became protective of the fawn and helped it to find its food, helped it to find its water, slept with it, followed it around, really took care of it.
Similarly sweet story, the piglet and the Rottweiler. The photo, almost just too much to believe. It's a little piglet curled up with a bunch of Rottweiler puppies.
It is sort of a perfect image, this little pink face sticking up among the black puppies. But this was, another case of really a parenting story where the mother dog took in this little runt as part of her litter of puppies and really didn't seem concerned at all that this animal, you know, supposedly didn't belong with the other ones. She allowed it to nurse and took care of it just as well as she would take care of her own.
So some animals, it seems, can't resist the urge to parent, even if the baby is from a different species. Is there a scientific reason for this or explanation?
Well, I think there's a very, very strong instinct in mammals to parent, especially for the mothers. And I think that goes way, way back. That's, you know, evolutionarily, that makes a lot of sense because you, the better you take care of young ones, the more likely they're going to survive and pass on the genes, you know, for the next round. So I think that comes from deep within and comes from way back in our evolution and is pretty much across the board with mammals. I think there's a really a special and unique kind of need to be a parent and to care for others.
The second section of the book is called Eat, Play, Love. Now, this is about animals finding friendship or playmates in different species. Friendship may be another one of those anthropomorphic words that scientists may not like to use. But you write that friendship is important for animals. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think, again, just like humans, other mammals need companionship, and companions can help to reduce stress, can help them get through a difficult time. Play behavior is very important for young animals to kind of learn how to respond to others and how to protect themselves and to be aggressive if they need to. So there's a lot of aspects of friendship that we're used to in the human world that can certainly apply in the animal world as well.
Well, one that seems pretty unlikely is the giraffe and the goat called Gerald and Eddie. What can you tell us about them?
This is a sweet story. The giraffe was kind of waiting around at the zoo for a mate to be brought in, and he was kind of a lonely animal, so the staff there gave him a goat as a buddy, and it really turned out to be an unusually positive experience for the both of them. The goat was much more gregarious, much more just kind of paid attention to others, and the giraffe was much shyer. And in a sense, the goat sort of taught the giraffe how to be a friendlier animal and eventually how to relate to the female giraffe that was brought in. It was almost like he was the wingman. The goat was the wingman that made sure that the male giraffe knew what he was doing.
Well, how did they communicate? I mean, the height difference alone seems that it would be really difficult.
I know. That is a good question. These animals seem to come up with their own languages in a sense. And I think body language also is a really important part of that.
Jennifer Holland is with us. She's a contributing writer to National Geographic and author of a new book called Unlikely Loves, 43 heartwarming true stories from the animal kingdom. I don't want to be a downer here, Jennifer, but, you know, you talked about maternal instincts. There are a lot of other instincts that rule animals and their place on the food chain. Is there any worry of attacks between these animals that in the wild would be enemies?
Yeah, it is interesting because we don't really know in the wild how often you have this crossover of species care. And certainly more of the time you're going to have a predatory, a predator-prey relationship is going to be the norm. But occasionally in the wild, even, they do record, people have recorded relationships that don't really seem to make sense, where normally a predator actually takes a prey kind of under its wing and cares for it in a way that it wouldn't normally do. But in the cases of these more captive situations, the people are certainly aware of the potential danger, and I think, for the most part, they keep a good eye on the situation and make sure that there isn't any sort of aggression.
Well, here's one that's the visual says it all. There's a photograph of one of those swan boats, like we know from here in Boston, and a little swan tagging alongside. It looks like a rather ill-fated relationship.
It's a little sad. I don't think there's going to be any babies out of that one. But yeah, that was an interesting story in Germany in a lake. People started noticing that this female swan seemed to think that this boat was her mate. And she hung around with it all the time, followed it around, or vice versa. I'm not sure who was actually moving first. But it became such a phenomenon that people were concerned because the boat was supposed to be put away for the winter, and there was a rallying cry. Everybody wanted to make sure that the swan was able to stay with her mate, and so the city made a big effort to keep the animals together and so they could continue their strange relationship.
Well, Jennifer, we've already discussed that human beings might be guilty of projecting feelings of love or friendship or whatever human feelings we have onto animals when we see them. But what is it? You know, why do cute cat photos outnumber things that are passed around on the web, or most things that are passed around on the web, by such huge exponential numbers? What are we looking for?
It is kind of remarkable how this has become such a thing, these animal photos. I think part of it is just a need for happy, for positive. There's a side of us that really, really craves that sweetness. You know, it's the reason that we can take care of screaming newborn babies, is that we have this capacity to take in cute things and to really want to care for them and to care for helpless things. And I think that empathy is just such a powerful, powerful emotion in humans. And so when we see these stories of other animals having a similar emotion, I think it really touches us in a special way.
Well, Jennifer Holland, thank you so much for sharing some of these stories with us today.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer Holland, contributing writer to National Geographic and author of the new book, Unlikely Loves. It's full of photographs and adorable stories of adorable animals from the animal kingdom. You can see some of those photos and get more information on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. And on this farm he had some ducks, E-I-E-I-O. With a quack quack here, a quack quack there, here quack there, quack everywhere, quack quack, chick chick here, chick chick there, here chick there, chick everywhere, chick chick. Old MacDonald had a farm. All right, so maybe we have the idea that life on the tour bus is all sex, drugs, and rock and roll. The band Pearl and the Beard had to get past a misdemeanor sleepwalking charge to get to its next date. We're going to hear that story and a little music from a band who's on their way to Concord tomorrow. That's when Word of Mouth continues. And on this farm he had a Ford, E-I-E-I-O. With a clink, clink here, a clink, clink there, here, clink, there, clink, everywhere, clink, clink, oink, oink here, oink, oink there, here, oink there, oink everywhere, oink, oink, quack, quack here, quack, quack there, here, quack there, quack everywhere, quack, quack. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're listening to the song Reverend by the band Pearl and the Beard. How do I get there with these old feet? Wandering endless, oh, so it seems. People is talking, they talk about me. This song is off the 2011 album Killing the Darlings. For the last 3 years, Pearl and the Beard has been working on a new album while touring the country extensively and crafting a high-energy live show, which is making its way to Concord tomorrow night at the Capitol Center for the Arts. Producer Zach Nugent spoke with Pearl and the Beard's Jocelyn McKenzie, Emily Hope Price, and Jeremy Stiles, and asked for their best stories from the road.
Oh, yes! I was just telling this story to a friend the other day, and... Okay, so once upon a time, we toured Chicago... And we have the loveliest friends there. Alexis and Scott were living here. And they actually had two different apartments. So we, Jocelyn and I, this is Emily, stayed with Alexis. And Jeremy decided to stay with Scott. And Jeremy fell asleep in Scott's apartment on the couch, made up as a bed. The next morning, he wakes up and a woman is screaming at him, saying, "What are you doing in my apartment? Why are you here?" Turns out Jeremy had sleepwalked into someone else's apartment and fell asleep on their couch.
He basically woke up in the back of a cop car in handcuffs, completely disoriented. So that was simultaneously probably one of the best and worst tour stories. It was terrible for Jeremy, but it was very funny for everyone.
I remember, I remember being like, well, I guess I can't. Because once I started waking up more and more, because from the handcuffs digging into my wrists, I was like, oh, well, I guess I... guess I can't play these next shows. I guess I have to go to jail now.
Well, you have a new album coming out this year, 3 years in the making. How's that recording process going?
This new stuff is so much more, even more collaborative than our past work. I mean, our past work was very collaborative in a different way. And this work, we all of us love so many different kinds of music, and we don't really overlap very much. We have such different tastes, and I think this is probably that great a culmination of all of our tastes together.
Well, you've released one song from that new album. It's called You. Let's give it a listen.
Some of the lyrics for You, I was inspired by a drunk text message or a drunk voicemail that my husband left me a while ago. And he basically called me. I was on tour and he called me. He's like, "Get it through your head. I love you." Ugh. And he was just so determined to drunkenly convince me that I was loved, which was very appreciated. And it was just a very funny sentiment. Like, get it through your head. Like, stop freaking doubting this. So that kind of became the inspiration for the lyrics.
Yeah, it's not just in your head. My whole body is your home. I will keep you as the world goes on and on around us. Yeah, oh, it's not just in your head. My whole body is your home. I will keep you as the world goes on and on around us. Yeah.
One of my favorite tracks off the last album, Killing the Darlings, is Sweetness. Let's listen to a bit of that.
Sweetness was one of those first ones that I was like, oh, maybe we'll start being louder. That would be awesome. I'd like to play my electric guitar some more. I think I was thinking about the life of a musician at the time, being like, I usually go to sleep like way late at night, and like if you're with somebody who has, you know, quote, a normal job, they're like getting up really early in the morning, and so it's like you're both seeing a sunrise essentially, but like I'm seeing it as I'm coming home and you're seeing it when you woke up really early, and you kind of just like high-five each other in passing, and then one of you passes out and the other one wakes up and goes to work.
Sweetness, we see the exact same sunrise. Sweetness, we see the exact same sunrise. On different sides, yeah, sides of the morning. On different sides, yeah, sides of the morning.
On 2014 is shaping up to be a big year for you guys, with a new album and a new tour. What are you looking forward to in the coming year?
My hope for 2014 for the band is that we can be as open with how the next year or two are going to shape up with, you know, possibilities or opportunities or where this album is going to take us, as we were open to just letting the songs become what they wanted to be. Because I think that was the biggest reward, was just discovering what the songs were, what they were once they were already done. And I think at this stage to say like, oh, well, this year we were planning this, 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 and this, it would not do justice to that writing process. And, you know, we could potentially have a lot of surprises along the way. So I'm looking forward to that.
It's true, you guys. I really feel that way.
Douglas, Douglas, apple tree. have a wife, now let her be. Give me what you got. I'm gonna make you what you're not.
Jocelyn McKenzie, Emily Hope Price, and Jeremy Stiles there of the band Pearl in the Beard. They're going to be at the Capitol Center for the Arts in Concord tomorrow night. For more information, head on over to wordofmouthradio.org.
Dip you in my bowl.
Whether touring the country like Pearl in the Beard or practicing in the basement, all musicians had to start somewhere and pick up an instrument for the first time and played those first wrong notes and then tried again and again and again. Producer Eric Drachman found one such story of Ryan Fletcher, an air conditioner installer from Cape Cod, who found his passion, the djembe.
Ryan Fletcher can rip it up now on his djembe, but it wasn't always so easy. He'd been a fan of music, but he never imagined himself making music. Even he says that his first attempts weren't so great.
Pretty bad. I had one rhythm. I was like a one rhythm, and I'm as white as they come, so I just didn't even know how to feel that.
3 years ago, completely on a whim, Ryan grabbed his brother's drum at a music festival. He'd never touched a drum before.
It was one of these really cool little sleepover festivals. So you're there for 3 days, and when the band shut down at the end of the night, most of the band members stayed. And so I ended up getting in on that drum circle and realized, oh my God, and it was wonderful, like life-changing wonderful, and all I knew how to do was boom, boom, boom. That's all I did. That whole, for the 3 days, boom. I didn't know anymore. I really didn't know anymore. But I could carry that rhythm. And it was kind of when I realized that it really is magic.
Ryan was hooked. He came home, bought a drum, and started practicing.
It was horrible.
That's Tara, Ryan's wife.
Like, to be honest with you, it was, I mean, but anything that you begin, you have to practice to get better at. And so the repetitive of the horrible noise... It was tough.
Ryan's kids felt the same way. They banished him to the RV out in the driveway. That's okay with Ryan. This is where he keeps all his toys now.
All kinds of little... This is my shaker. This is my favorite shaker. It's a Baron.
The RV has become Ryan's man cave. Or should I say his drumming cave. He says he's out here... 5 nights a week, sometimes 2 hours at a time.
That's my lunchbox.
Ryan hears rhythms everywhere, even on construction sites where he works, installing heating and air conditioning systems. When a rhythm grabs him, he'll tap it out on a spare piece of PVC pipe if it's handy.
If that's what it takes, yeah, 2x4, anything, 2x4s, anything that's around a job site works.
Ryan's taken a few lessons, scoured YouTube for the best African drummers, and spent a lot of lonely hours practicing on his own. It's paid off.
Major improvement. I mean, it's still really loud, and our house is small, and I work insane hours. So when you want to start drumming when I'm, you know, doing sleep time, it's horrible. But I like seeing him that happy because he's never had an outlet. So that helps outweigh how noisy the drums can be.
I've never done anything that's actually where you actually perform, where it's actually something that people enjoy.
Ryan doesn't get that same appreciation installing air ducts.
I mean, everything I do gets buried in a wall and no one wants to see it, no one wants to hear it. But this is something that's completely different.
Ryan wants to be heard, and he yearns to play with others. So for now, he practices where it won't bother anyone, but jumps at the chance to play with a group. Like at the new drum circle at the Kituat Center for the Arts.
There's this feeling like a high. When everyone starts to mesh around together, and then you realize what a beautiful thing it is.
For WCAI's Creative Life, I'm Eric Drachman.
Well, thank you for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there is plenty more to listen to and to share at wordofmouthradio.org.
And don't forget, we are looking for you to rouse your inner romantic and help producer Taylor Quimby finish up the Word of Mouth love song. That's an original song made up entirely of lyrical cliches. Well, things for Taylor did not go so well.
You looked at me, and I looked at you, and our eyes locked, and I looked away. Then I looked back at your eyes.
So, we gave you the seeds of the song, the lyrics, and the chords. They're all at wordofmouthradio.org, and asked you to make your own cover or interpretation and share it with us. I'm Virginia Prescott. Science Friday is in this spot tomorrow. You can hear more Word of Mouth on Saturday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio, or listen anytime to the Word of Mouth podcast on iTunes or at wordofmouthradio.org.